We are doing the Ein Yaakov, being that this is a new semester, so we'll quickly review our introduction to Ein Yaakov. If you want a more lengthy and detailed introduction to the Ein Yaakov, so we have online, we have a whole class introducing the Ein Yaakov, and I wrote up a whole summary introducing the Ein Yaakov, which you could view online at torahforme.org. So basically, the Ein Yaakov was written by a contemporary of Rav Yosef Karo, the Maharal Bach's father, and he wrote the Ein Yaakov, a summary where he takes out the stories from the Gemara. During the years following the writing of the Ein Yaakov, the Christian church banned the printing of the Talmud and burnt many, many copies of the Talmud. And they reached a point where you couldn't find the Talmud throughout many countries. You'd have to go searching to find the printed Talmud. At one point, they alleviated this decree and they permitted the printing of the Ein Yaakov. And there was a period of approximately a few decades where in many countries you could not get your hands on a Talmud, but you could get your hands on the Ein Yaakov. So the Jews could only learn the stories of the Talmud. And from that period onward, the Ein Yaakov became a staple item in Jewish homes, where many shuls, after Mincha, they used to learn Ein Yaakov. When the older people and people would get together for Minyan, if they had time after Minyan, before Minyan, they would learn Ein Yaakov. Because it's something that's very pleasant. You're just learning the stories of the Talmud without too much halacha, but it's very interesting. And so the Ein Yaakov spends the Talmud. He himself did not complete the work. His son completed the work. He didn't finish doing it on all of the Talmud. And the Ein Yaakov also goes with, it quotes from the Jerusalem Talmud, but that was also not completed. Now, we have many commentaries on the Ein Yaakov. In the printing of the Ein Yaakov, so they summarized Rashi. They quoted the Rashi that's relevant to the Gemara that the Ein Yaakov quotes, and they quoted the Marsha that's relevant. And then he himself, the author, the one who compiled it, wrote his own commentary that's printed here. And then as generations passed, more and more commentaries wrote on the stories of the Talmud and were printed in the Ein Yaakov. So today, when we learn Ein Yaakov, we're learning the text from the Gemara. But in my preparations, I look over the commentaries, all the different commentaries that I could get my hands on in preparation for the class. So now let's begin. We're holding the beginning of the second chapter of Brachot. And the Mishnah basically said that when a person's servant passes away, so we have to take care not to eulogize him too much and not to lament his passing, lest people think that he has good yichus. He's not Jewish. We know that an Eved Kenani, a non-Jewish slave, after being purchased, we give him a year to decide. Do you want to accept mitzvot like a woman? So then, within a year, if he says yes, then he gets circumcision. We make a blessing. There's a special blessing on the circumcision of a servant. And he goes to mikveh. And he goes to mikveh with the intent that he is now accepting mitzvot like a woman. And now for the rest of his life, he will be an Eved Kenani. And he is obligated to perform mitzvot like a woman. So he's this quasi-Jew. He's not really a full-fledged ger. He's not really a full-fledged non-Jew. If his master ever frees him, then he will be automatically obligated to do all mitzvot. He'll have to... Okay, we won't go into that whole procession, how he goes from being an Eved Kenani to a full-fledged Jew. But bottom line, he doesn't have an option of opting out. So we give the Eved Kenani a year to decide, do you want this or not? If you don't, we'll sell you to a non-Jew. If you want to remain in a Jewish home, so then you have to accept these laws. If he accepts it, then he remains as an Eved Kenani. When he passes away, the Mishnah says, we don't eulogize over him. It's not your son, it's not your brother. We don't eulogize unless people start saying that his children are full-fledged Jews. There'll be a confusion about his yichus. And the Gemara quotes in a Braisa that says, they used to use a term of honor, just like we'd say Mr., they used to say Abba. Abba so-and-so. Like Mr. So-and-so. So the Gemara tells us, for a servant, you should never call a servant Abba so-and-so. We don't want people to start thinking he's your father. And then you'll have conflict of people won't know his yichus. So the Mishnah says, don't call them Abba. And in this, the Braisa says that. And in quoting that, so then the Gemara quotes another Braisa, which discusses who are called our Avot. And that's where we will begin. We're in the Ein Yaakov page, Mem Beis, Amud Beis, and the pages of the Mem Ein Yaakov. which really corresponds to the Gemara, page Tes Zayin. Tano Rabbanan, we have a Braisa which has good validation. Tano Rabbanan means it is a Braisa that has good sources. We know there were Braises that they weren't sure if they were so accurate. When it begins Tano Rabbanan, means this one, the rabbis used to quote, it was a Braisa that was validated, that it was quoted correctly. En korin avot ela legimin. We don't call avos, forefathers, patriarchs, we only call three. En korin imahot ela ledalet. There are only four women that get the status of our imahot, our matriarchs. So the Gemara questions. We know our four matriarchs are Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. Our three forefathers are Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Avot Maitaima. What's the reasoning that avos we only name three as our forefathers? Ilema, if you'll tell me, the reason is Mishum Delo Yadinan, because we don't know Im Reuven Katinan, Im Shimon Katinan. We don't know which tribe we come from. I know I'm not a Kohen or a Levi, but am I from Yehuda? Am I from Reuven? Am I from Shimon? Is that the reason why I can't call the tribes my forefathers? Ihachi, if that's so, Imahot Nami Lo Yadinan. We don't know the matriarchs. We don't know if we come from Rachel or Leah. Do I come from the tribe of Yosef or Binyamin and then I'm from Rachel? Or do I come from the tribe of Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, and then I'm from the tribe of Leah? So that can't be the reason why. It can't be because we don't know who is our direct mother. Because we still call Rachel and Leah our mothers, and yet we don't know if they're genetically our mothers, biologically our mothers. Ela, but rather the reason is ad hachashivi, till Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, they are considered on one level of importance, that they implemented the Jewish people with their traits, and their righteousness isn't just a question of being tzaddikim, but their righteousness is on a level that they're considered the source for the things that we do. Tzvei lo chashivi, beyond that, they're not on that level of importance. Reuven, Shimon, Levi, they're huge tzaddikim. But we don't say that they gave the traits of the Jewish people. We say in the Mishnah and Avos, Avraham Avinu was tested 10 tests. So there's the famous Rav Chaim asks, why does that Mishnah say Avraham Avinu was tested 10 tests? Why does the Mishnah stress that he is our forefather? So he says, you look around today, you'll see in any given generation, there are many people that have difficult tests. In the Holocaust, there weren't people who stood up to difficult tests. In the Spanish Inquisition, there weren't people that stood up to difficult tests. In the last decade, there weren't people in Russia and in Iran and all over the world that stood up to difficult tests. So people might say, you know what? Yeah, Avram had his 10 tests and I have mine. Look at all the people, Gilad Shalit's parents, they're not standing up to a difficult test. Gilad Shalit himself, Jonathan Pollard. You have Jews today who are standing up to very, very difficult tests. So a person might think, you know what? Avram, he stood up to his tests, and we're standing up to our tests. The Mishnah comes and tells us, Avram Avinu stood up to 10 tests. The Mishnah says, Avram Avinu, Avram our forefather. What the Mishnah is teaching us is, just like a father, when he has a son, we say, the son takes after his father. He'll take the same tribe as his father. He'll take the family name of his father. He takes certain qualities of his father. There are certain things that you get from your father, whether you like it or not. If your father was balding, you might be balding. If your father was a redhead, you might be a redhead. There are certain physical features, but there are also personality traits that we do get from our forefathers. We could work on them, but our tendencies are going to follow our forefathers. So when Avram stood up to these tests, it's as though he placed the seal on his genes that we would have the power to stand up to tests. It's true that we stand up to tests, but the Mishnah is telling us that when Avram stood up to the tests, he not only stood up for himself, but he implemented within his family the strength to stand up to those tests. So that when we stand up today, it's true, we're standing up to the test. But part of the strength that we have to stand up to that test is stemming from the fact that Avram himself stood up to the tests. So this characteristic, that they're implementing within the people characteristic traits, that is unique to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Yaakov sealed it. Avram still worked very, very hard, but he wasn't perfect. So he had a son named Yishmael, who went off the derech. Yitzchak worked very, very hard, but he didn't perfect it. He had a son named Esau. Yaakov sealed it off. Yaakov finished closing off the circle, and that's why Yaakov had all his children, anyone from Yaakov onward, we say, a Jew that sins is still a Jew. He may be a sinful Jew, but he's a Jew. Once you're born a Jew, you can't get out. Once you become a ger and become a Jew, you can't get out. From Yaakov onward, we have that rule. Up to Yaakov, you see, Yitzhak had a son that was sinful, he's not Jewish. Avram had a son that was sinful, he's not Jewish. The only one that sealed it off from his day and onward, once a Jew, always a Jew, is Yaakov. So this sealing off of the Jewish people, that's only those three forefathers. And the matriarchs, the mothers, they also implemented within the Jewish people certain traits, and that sealed off with Sarah, Rivka, Rachaleah. Yeah? God commanded him to give them Brit Milah. It has nothing to do with being Jewish. According to the Rambam, Arabs are still considered, or Yishma'ilim, are considered obligated to do Brit Milah. The Rambam has a unique shita in the laws of Brit Milah. He says, God commanded Avram and his offsprings. So Yishmael is also obligated. Yishmael's offsprings are also obligated to do Brit Milah. Yeah? So that's a good question. Maybe we'll discuss it this week in the Parsha of Brit Milah, in our Parsha class. Maybe we'll get there. I'm a Moel. I do circumcision, so this stuff it will come up. It's a good question. If we don't get there in Wednesday's Parsha class, remind me to get there in Thursday's question and answer class. Okay? This Gemara tells us a few very interesting facts. Number one, people sometimes question, do we know what tribe we are from? We see from this Gemara that even in the time of the Gemara, they didn't know what tribe they were from. If you're a Kohen or a Levi, so you know you come from the tribe of Levi. If you come from the house of the Nasi, so you know the Nasim came from David HaMelech. There were people, Rashi, the Shlach Kodosh, there were unique individuals throughout history who had a tradition. There are still families today that have their lineage back to David HaMelech. I have such a thing. It was emailed to me by a friend of mine. His family has a lineage all the way back to David HaMelech. There are people who have that. There are unique individuals today who still have that. But most people have no clue what tribe they're from. So we don't have to feel too badly about it, because we see in the times of the Gemara, they didn't know. So that's one thing we see from this Gemara. Another interesting point is that the Gemara gave an example of two tribes, Reuven and Shimon. And we have to wonder whether the Gemara literally meant Reuven and Shimon, because we know the 10 tribes were exiled. So people sometimes question, are Jews today all from the tribe of Yehuda that wasn't exiled, and maybe Shimon that was still around over there, and the tribe of Binyamin, whose portion was right near Yehuda, and they weren't exiled also? So are all Jews that are not Kohanim and Levim just Yehuda, Binyamin, and Shimon? And I always say no, because according to one opinion of the Gemara, the Navi Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, brought back many people from the 10 tribes. And even if you don't go with that opinion, there are still Jews from the other tribes who were around Jerusalem. It's not that there are no Jews left from those tribes. Aside from which, we have a covenant, we have a pact, that the 12 tribes will always exist. So if you go with the opinion that the 10 tribes are still living somewhere over the river of Sambatyon, so you could say, yeah, maybe they're not here, but you have 10 tribes somewhere hiding out there, we're still going to meet them one day. But if you don't go with that opinion, so then you have to say that living among us, you have people from those 10 tribes. And this Gemara seems to be supporting that every Jew might be from the tribe of Reuven or Shimon. You could say that the Gemara just meant to give an example. Reuven and Shimon, those are the first two tribes. But I would be reluctant to say that. I would sooner say that the Gemara literally meant every Jew might be from the tribe of Reuven or the tribe of Shimon. And really, all of us might be from any one of the 10 tribes. So long as you're not a Kohen or a Levi. If you're a Kohen or a Levi, you know you come from the tribe of Levi, right? Okay, so that's just two interesting points that we notice in passing from this Gemara. Yes, sir?
Who can be sure that he's a Kohen or a Levi?
Well, if a Jew walks in and says, I'm a Kohen, we let him go in Durin, we let him get Kohen. You're right. I didn't want to touch on that. I thought I'd get away with giving you that answer. I'd rather not go into it, but in general, we trust a person when he says he's a Kohen or a Levi.
Because he thinks he's a
oh, wait, because his father told him he's a kohen, and his father told him, and the whole community treats him as a kohen. Look, if we don't do that, then what's going to happen is, if a kohen comes and asks us, can I marry this divorced lady? If I don't really believe him that he's a kohen, then how could I tell him no? And yet, we do tell him no. If a kohen walks in and says, there's the famous story about the Baal Tshuva and Rav Soloveitchik. You guys know the story? A guy comes to Rav Soloveitchik and he says, you know, I want to get married. It's a sadder story than that. Okay, a guy is irreligious. And he's dating a girl who's not Jewish. And they decide they want to get married. And she tells him, let's check your past a little bit more. And they start studying about Judaism. And he likes it, and she likes it. And they learn more and more about it, their boyfriend and girlfriend. And then she decides she's going to convert and become Jewish, and she does. And he decides he's going to do tshuva. So he becomes religious, and she becomes religious. And she becomes a Jew, she becomes a giyoret, and he's chozer b'tshuva. And they want to get married now, halachically. They want to live a halachic life. So they get engaged, and they set a date for their marriage. And he was an orphan. And he heard somewhere that there's a custom that before an orphan gets married, a few weeks beforehand, you go to the grave and you bring an invitation to your father. So you, even though the father can't make it to the wedding, you go to the grave and you say, Dad, you know, I'm getting married in this date, and I'd be honored if you come. So he heard of this custom and he liked it. So he did some research as to where his father's graveyard was, and he bought a ticket and he flew out to his father's graveyard and he brought the invitation. And when he was there, he took a picture of the tombstone. And he comes back with the picture, and he goes over to a friend, and he says, you know, there's this funny hands on the tombstone. I don't know what does it mean? So his friend looks at the picture, and he says, oh, that's the way the hands, the Kohanim hold their hands when they make a blessing. You're probably a Kohen. So the guy says, well, I don't know. I mean, I grew up not religious. I don't know anything about it. So they try to do research, and they came to Rav Soloveitchik with the question, and they asked Rav Soloveitchik, can he marry her? Because a kohen is not allowed to marry a woman who became a giyoret past the age of 3, which is every giyoret, right? Every woman became a giyoret past the age of 3, almost. Almost every woman is that way. So they came to Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Soloveitchik sat on the question for a long time, trying to find the leniency, and in the end he ruled that they cannot get married. And this pair of tzaddikim, this young couple, they broke their engagement, they broke their wedding, and each one married someone else. They're happily married today. But this is a very, very famous story about two tzaddikim. Look, they went this whole journey together. She became a giyoret. He did tshuva. And they were planning. They already had a wedding invitation. They had the wedding date set. Everything was all set up. And then they discovered that he's a kohen. Now, that's an example of a story where a guy comes in and he says he's a kohen. And we believe him. And we even tell him that he cannot get married to the girl of his dreams, the girl who he's been thinking his whole last few years, his whole religious life, she's going to be his wife. We say, you can't. So you see that halachically, we do take it very seriously when a guy says he's a kohen. You're right that if we had to give truma and meiser, and if a guy already married a woman who's a divorcee or things like that, there's a discussion in halacha, are we certain enough that we can take legal action against him? Because we're certain to, let's say, a certain degree. But it's not 100%. And we have a biblical mitzvah of pidyon haben. We still give pidyon haben to a kohen. We make a blessing on it. I had a firstborn son, right? So I have to redeem that son giving 5 silver coins to a kohen. That's a biblical mitzvah. And I give the coins to a kohen. So you see, even in biblical mitzvot, we do assume that a guy who tells us is a kohen, he is a kohen. So there's more to be discussed about that. But in general, we do assume it. Yeah. Right, that's also true, right?
It would be a violation.
Right. So in general, we take things at face value. He says he's a kohen, he's a kohen. That's the general halacha, even in extenuating circumstances like that couple that were already ready to get married. Okay, let's continue. We got sidetracked. Now, the next section that we're going to learn focuses on a pasuk in Tehillim, and I would like us to take a minute to learn that chapter in Tehillim. It is every chapter in Tehillim is a masterpiece, and this chapter is no different. So let's open to Tehillim, Perek Samach Gimel, the 63rd chapter. Tell me when you all have it. Mizmor David, Biotov Midbar Yehuda. So we all know the story that David HaMelech married King Saul's daughter, Michal. He was King Saul's son-in-law, and he was an exceptional warrior. And King Saul sinned, Shaul HaMelech sinned, and he was told that his friend, who is better than him, will take the throne from him. And Shaul figured out that the one who was going to take the throne from him was none other than his son-in-law, David. And Shaul started chasing David, trying to execute him. Shaul ruled halachically that David had rebelled against the throne and doing certain things. And so Shaul held that halachically he is permitted to execute David as a person who is rebelling against him. David claimed he was innocent and that he did not deserve to be killed, and ran, and David amassed his own army. And David was on the run, on the verge of death many times, almost starving to death at one point in his life, being surrounded at another point in his life. David spent a period that was very, very nerve-wracking and difficult, running away from his father-in-law, the king of Israel, Shaul. And at one point, he had to run out into the desert of Yehuda. And David HaMelech, at that point, composed the following song of Psalms. And as we know, all of the songs and Psalms were composed with Ruach HaKodesh, with a level of prophecy, and that's why they're incorporated into the Tanakh. So David HaMelech says as follows. We're holding Tehillim, Perek Samach Gimel, the 63rd chapter. Mizmor leDavid, a song that David HaMelech composed, Biyoto beMidbar Yehuda, when he was in the desert of Yehuda. You guys ever been to Midbar Yehuda? You guys know how vast and arid and hot the desert of Yehuda can be. And he's on the run. And David HaMelech says, Elokim Eli Ata, the Omnipotent One, you are my strength. Ashachareka, I will seek you out. You'd think he's in the desert, he's going to say, God, I seek you out, I'm thirsty, help me out. I'm hungry, give me food. What does he say? Sam'a lecha nafshi. My soul thirsts for you, God. I might be here in the heat. I'm not focused on my physical thirst. My thirst is for you. Kama lecha besari. My flesh yearns for you. The eretz tziya ve'ayef belimayim, in this arid, dry land without water. I'm here without water, but my focus, God, is that I am so perturbed, so saddened, that I am in the desert, distant from the ark, distant from the aron, distant from the ability to go before your holy temple and pray. And even though I'm in this heat, I'm stuck in the desert on the run for my life, my focus is what? Sama lecha nafshi. My soul is thirsting for you. Kein bakodesh chaziticha. I wait for the time that I will see you just as I have seen you in the holy place. Lir'ot uzcha uchvodecha. To see your strength and glory at your temple. You will notice that one of the characteristic traits of the great people, and specifically the Davidic dynasty, is the ability to arise above the moment. At every given time in one's life, there are things that one can focus on. I'm looking for a job. My landlord's threatening to kick me out. I can't find food that I can afford. Right now the stock market is crashing. The doctor says, I have to check out my heart. There are always major issues in one's life. Like Rav Schachter quotes, one of his rabbeim once told him, try to find a woman that has a sense of humor. Because life has too many catastrophes to deal with him with someone that doesn't have a sense of humor. Life is going from one catastrophe to another. I know you guys are still young in yeshiva and you don't feel it so much. But believe me, once you start living, once you start dealing with real life, you're going to see that that's what life is all about. There's never a dull moment. And at every moment, one can have an excuse for not learning Torah or not davening with Kavanah or not doing what he's supposed to do, because at every given moment, there are a lot of issues to deal with. If you're leading a normal life, you have issues to deal with. And one of the things we have to learn from David, and it's a reoccurring theme in Tehillim and in the Megillah of Ruth, which is the source of David HaMelech, is that ability to master time, to master the catastrophes and not let the catastrophes master our lives. Life is filled with catastrophes. No one gets away free. Sometimes you see someone who seems to have a calm life. The only thing calm about it is what you see. You think his life is calm. If you only know what's going on beyond the surface, you'll know that his life is not calm. The only people who lead calm lives are those whose lives we don't know about. When you don't know about it, then their lives are calm. If you really know what's going on, you'll know that their lives are all but calm. David HaMelech is in the desert. He has to fend for his life. You know, there are wild animals there. There's the king of Israel chasing him out. There are many spies who know there's a bounty on his head. If they'll only help Shaul, Shaul will give him everything. David HaMelech isn't focused about that. He's focused about his relationship to God. When Naomi and Ruth come back to Israel, they don't have food to put on the table. Naomi just lost her husband, her wealth, all her real estate, her children. And Naomi says, my focus isn't on that. My focus is on the famine that's happening in Israel. My focus is on others. Ruth, her focus is on her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law focuses on her. Great people overcome the moment. Great people overcome their own pain. A sign of greatness is when things are tough, who do I think about? Is my focus on, oh, it's hurting me? Or is my focus on, what do they need? David HaMelech is roaming the desert and he says to God, my thirst is for you. My yearning is for you when I am in this dry land. Ken avarechecha v'chayai, just as I once blessed you in my life, so do I seek out to bless you again with my life. B'shimcha esach apai, and I will raise my hands in prayer towards your name. And that is the pasuk that our Gemara is going to focus on. Ken avarechecha v'chayai, b'shimcha esach apai. Yes, Meir. Could be. Could very well be. Ken v'kodesh chaziticha, we explain. Just I'm using computer. The computer skips back and forth. Just a second. Let me see how I can get it to display all the psukim.
This is a little Bob Sharevi, like last song that he made.
Yeah, I love this song.
Yeah.
We have it on the web a few times. Ken Bakodesh Chaziticha. So too, thank you, Mir. Yeah. Sure. Ken has a few meanings. Ken means yes. Ken means it is just, it is true. And Ken means as well. Ken over here means as well. Just as I have, I will as well in the future. Ken, just as I have, Bakodesh Chaziticha L'chot U'Schar Kvodecha, I will do it in the future as well.
Chaziticha is which
tense? Past tense. What?
It's not a contradiction.
Why?
Is he saying that in the past I seek your glory?
I'm not following the question, sorry.
Can you explain the pasuk to me?
Yeah. Ken, so too I will, just as I have in the past, Bakodesh Chaziticha, seen you in the holiness. Ken means so too I will. And then there's an inferred understanding of, just as in the past I have, Bakodesh Chaziti Chasinu, in the holiness in the holy temple in Shiloh, Lirot Uzcha Uchvodecha, to see your so that could be understood either way, I'm not sure. Lirot could be understood, I was in the past there to see your strength and honor, or it could go back on Ken, I will see. That could be understood, I think, either way. I don't know. He's saying, I thirst for you, Hashem, and I will see you again just as I have seen you. I know I'll get back, but you should know now that I'm not there, I'm thirsting for it. I'm yearning for it. God is everywhere, but there are places where God is more revealed. You go to a shul, it's not like davening at home. Even if there isn't a minyan there, one should prefer to daven in shul. Yeah. Right? Okay, I don't think it's so problematic, but if you don't like this pirush, we'll go with a different pirush. There is, yeah. I'm thirsting to see you, and so too I will, just as I have, I will see you in your glorious place. But if you don't like this explanation, there's an alternate one. There's another understanding that says, just as my thirst for you, Hashem, so too I have a thirst to see you as I have seen you. Ken goes on the thirst. Just as my thirst that I stated in the previous pasuk, so too I have a thirst for Bakodesh Chaziticha, that which I have seen you in the past tense, I'm still yearning and thirsting to see you again in the holy place. But that isn't our focus. Our Gemara is going to focus on the next pasuk, Kitov Chastecha Mechayim, for your kindness is greater than life, Sefata Yeshavchuncha, my lips praise you, so too, or I will praise you, I will bless you in my life, with your name I will raise my hands in prayer. And on this pasuk is what our Gemara is going to focus. So let's quickly read the Gemara, just as an introduction for next class, because we're out of time. You guys have to run up for Alvit. So just quickly read the Gemara, and then next time we'll begin with this pasuk in the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Elazar said, "My dichtiv." What does the verse mean? Ken avarecha bechayai b'shimcha esakapai. So too, I will bless you in my life. With your name, I will raise my hands in prayer. Ken avarechecha. So too, I will prayer. I will bless you. Zokriat Shema. That's a reference to the reading of Shema. B'shimcha esakapai zutfila. With your name, I will raise my hand. That's a reference to prayer. Ve'imasachen. And if he does, and if he did so, pray and say Shema, alav ha-katuv omer, about him the verse says, the next verse, k'mo chelev ha-deshen tisba nafshi, v'sifte renanot yalelti. My soul is satiated like I would have brought a sacrifice of chelev and deshen, v'lo od, and not only that, but if he says Shema and prays the way he should, et ha-shenochel bet olamim ha-olam hazeh va-olam haba, he will merit this world and the world to come, as the verse says, v'sifte renanot yalelti. My lips will sing multiple praises in this world and praises in the world to come. So now we've just seen an overview of the Gemara, and Be'ezrat Hashem, next time we'll have to talk in depth, what did the Gemara just do here? How did the Gemara take this verse of David HaMelech and derive these concepts from this verse? And we'll get more depth, Be'ezrat Hashem, next time.